mountains, deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. This article is entitled Time Traveling at Yuma Crossing. Text by Philip Varney. Photographs by Fred Griffin. I enter the camp with caution, even uncertainty, but I feel instantly more comfortable as he welcomes me warmly to his fire on this cool sunny morning. I ask him what news has reached the crossing. He informs me California has petitioned for statehood, and that poses a problem. Will it enter as a free or a slave state? He speaks knowledgeably, having just returned from the gold fields. Currently, he notes, we have exactly 15 free and 15 slave states. California will create an imbalance. I nod, glad to be reminded of the problem that resulted in the Missouri Compromise. I feel like a time traveler as I enter the Yuma Crossing Quartermaster Depot Historic State Park in Yuma, Arizona, in the mid-1990s. My fellow traveler is here as well, only he is living the year 1850. He is among four people at Yuma Crossing's immigrant camp, reviving the past in the only historical recreation west of the Mississippi. The immigrants follow the 1850 calendar as if it were their own, reacting to news of Indian attacks and gold strikes. Their clothing has no zippers. Their coffee is hand-ground and incredibly strong. The one who welcomed me to the fire, whom I consider my immigrant, is different from the others. He has seen the gold rush and is returning, disappointed and disillusioned, to his St. Louis home. My immigrant, the most gregarious of the group, is openly curious about me, the new arrival at camp. "What is your trade?" he queries. When I reply I am a writer, he says, "For Harper's Weekly, perhaps?" I grope for an answer. There is no Arizona Highways in 1850. "No, I only aspire to Harper's. I'm a reporter for the Weekly Arizonian in Tubac." He smiles. "Ah, Tubac, old Spanish settlement." I smile wanly. The newspaper, Arizona's first, debuted in 1859. I've blown it, but fortunately my Argonaut doesn't know that. I am here at the immigrant camp on Yuma Crossing Day, the last Sunday in February, which celebrates Yuma's importance to the opening of the West. Yuma is a place where history runs deep. When Spaniards first navigated north from the Sea of Cortez up the Colorado River in 1540, they peaceably encountered seven Indian tribes whom the Spaniards collectively called Yumans. The leader of the party, Hernando de Alacan, had been sent on an unsuccessful expedition to reprovision Coronado as he searched fruitlessly for the fabled Seven Cities of Gold. The Spanish finally established an outpost and mission in 1779 with Father Francisco Garces in charge. The location was important because it was near the confluence of the Gila and Colorado rivers, where the Colorado would be crossed relatively easily. The Spaniards coexisted with the Yuma tribe that lived at the confluence, the Quitzan, until the Spanish broke promises made to the Indians. A 1781 uprising left 101 Spanish dead, including Father Garces. The Spanish never again attempted to occupy Quitzan lands. The first Americans to view Yuma Crossing were mountain men and trappers, including James Ohio Patty in 1826 and Kit Carson, who with a trapping party in 1829 gathered a huge harvest of pelts and furs from the Colorado and Gila rivers. Carson returned in 1846 guiding a military expedition led by Colonel Stephen Watts Kearney. The 1849 gold rush dramatically altered the importance of Yuma Crossing. The subsequent flood of newcomers required military protection, so the U.S. Army established Camp Calhoun, later called Camp Yuma, on a promontory on the California side of the Colorado. The camp was upgraded in 1852 to Fort Yuma. Yuma developed into a keystone for the southwestern United States. It offered the best all-weather route to California. Even more importantly, the Quartermaster Depot, built on the riverbank in 1864, became the base from which military supplies sent up the Sea of Cortez and the Colorado River to Yuma were dispensed north to Fort Mojave and then east to Fort Whipple. Supplies also went east along the Gila Trail to fortify Fort McDowell, Fort Lowell, Fort Bowie, and Fort Huachuca, and as far away as New Mexico and western Texas as well. Quite simply, Yuma Crossing ensured the safe settlement of Arizona and New Mexico during the Apache Wars. Yuma's importance as a supply depot and fort declined when the Southern Pacific Railroad arrived in 1877 and the confrontations with the Indians ended. Because a railroad supplanted wagons as the cheapest, fastest way to send goods, the Quartermaster Depot closed in 1883. Fort Yuma ceased operations a year later. The completion of Laguna Dam in 1909 effectively ended river travel. Many motorists today think of Yuma as a refueling stop on the way to San Diego or as a refuge for winter visitors. It is much more, and Yuma Crossing Day gives the town a chance to strut its historical stuff. I began the day at the Yuma Crossing Quartermaster Depot Historic State Park, featuring our four 1850 immigrants encamped in a clearing near their wagons. The restored office of the quartermaster, built around 1872, contains informative displays ranging from military uniforms and weaponry to riverboat memorabilia. Adjacent to the office is an 1865 water reservoir. Nearby stands the commanding officer's home and kitchen, featuring period furniture and occasionally samples of 19th century recipes. The structure was built around 1859 as the grand residence of steamboat magnate George Alonzo Johnson. Here visitors can explore the entire building instead of merely peering into cordoned off rooms as is common at historic sites. One can even sit in chairs, play the piano, and feel the grain of an oak table. The immigrants outside may be reliving history, but it's alive inside the buildings of Yuma Crossing as well. Because my Crossing Day brochure lists so many activities, I leave the Quartermaster Depot to sample some of the other attractions, but I make a note to be sure to return for a guaranteed highlight, the renowned Dr. Thelonious Balthazar. More on the good doctor later. Near the crossing, I journey on the Yuma Valley Railroad, a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization that runs regular excursions from October through May. On this day, they do something special. They use a section of track extending from Yuma Crossing west along the Colorado River into agricultural fields. The 40-minute round-trip journey is filled with passengers, including many rail fans eager to traverse track used but once a year. After debarking the train, I head via a convenient and free day-long shuttle to historic downtown Yuma and the wonderful Arizona Historical Society Century House Museum. It features extensive displays from riverboats to trains, from conquistadors to General George Patton, and from mountain men to elegant ladies. One room contains a whimsical look at Yuma from 1927 until after World War II, when the town was a quick marriage mecca. Hollywood celebrities such as Tom Mix and Gloria Swanson, as well as soldiers heading off to war, brought their partners to Yuma to avoid California's 3-day waiting period for a marriage license. Outside the Century House is a living timeline. Volunteers specializing in the costumes, weaponry, memorabilia, and most importantly, the personalities of Spanish conquistadors, American soldiers, 19th century surveyors, photographers, even bandit Pearl Hart herself. Another shuttle stop takes me to the infamous Yuma Territorial Prison State Historical Park. The prison is only tangentially a part of Yuma Crossing Day. In fact, a ranger informs me that attendance at the state park is not substantially affected by the celebration. Nevertheless, it certainly is well worth a visit. Next stop is in California. The Quitzan Indian Museum in historic old Fort Yuma, today the tribe's headquarters. After the Army abandoned the site, it was transferred to the Department of the Interior and then to the Quitzan Indians. Exterior alterations to the fort have made it look considerably less historic than it is. But once inside the museum, formerly the commanding officer's kitchen, one can see the building's antiquity. The walls are 26 inches thick, and one section left exposed shows the original adobe construction. The exhibits proudly recount the history of the Quitzan people. My last stop is a Quartermaster Depot to see one of its star attractions, miracle medicine salesman Dr. Thelonious Balthazar, portrayed by Ohioan Michael Fallon, who spent 2 years researching medicine men of the past for his recreation. Dr. Balsavar is a glorious amalgam of every slick-talking pitchman from P.T. Barnum to the Home Shopping Channel. My good friends, you see before you a marvel of the medical world, a miracle of scientific discovery. Right here within this bottle is the elixir of life itself, nay, the very essence of the cosmos. The crowd enjoys the bantering and badgering of the doctor, who assures them their lives are about to change. To an elderly couple, Dr. Balthazar confides, "Madam, would you like a new man in your life for the small price of $1? Why, with one bottle, I can revitalize and rejuvenate your husband. I can send you two off on a second honeymoon. Would you enjoy that? Why, madam, I do believe I see a twinkle in your eyes, but I see fear in his." Several people stay after his quick, silver, smooth presentation and actually buy a bottle of his remarkable elixir, formulated from an ancient Tibetan recipe, but most are able to resist his felonious assault. Leaving Dr. Balthazar, I return again to the campsite of the immigrants. My immigrant is in a lively discussion with a befuddled visitor who asks, "See that flagpole over there? I want to know what that doohickey is beneath it." My time traveler replies, looking directly at the pole, "I see no flagpole. All I see is a bank before the river." The present-day visitor stares at him in disbelief. "What do you mean you don't see a flagpole? Look at the stars and stripes." I sidle next to the agitated tourist. "Do you know why he sees no flagpole, no stars and stripes, and no doohickey?" The visitor pauses a moment, and a wonderful look of understanding crosses his face. "Yes, yes, he's living in a different time." My immigrant smiles, I nod, and I leave the two wayfarers of the desert in a warm, animated conversation, now in different epochs, but on similar wavelengths. My friend of 1850 calls to me as I leave, "Best of luck on your article for the Arizonian." And this concludes Time Traveling at Yuma Crossing. The next article is The Great Arizona Volcano Scare, text by Janet Webb Farnsworth, illustration by Kevin J. Kissy. Tombstone residents first thought the rumbling noise was nothing more than another ore wagon passing by, but when the din rapidly increased until it sounded like a dynamite blast, they knew they had trouble. In the Crystal Palace Saloon, chandelier globes shattered on the floor and scattered the poker players. Deep down in the Tough Nut Mine, William F. Staunton yelled to his partner, Sam Cheney, "It's an earthquake. Get under something quick." Cheney replied from the depths of the mine, "The Lord knows I'm under enough already." The Sonoran earthquake, the largest known quake to hit the area, rocked the Arizona Territory on May 3, 1887. The Richter scale wasn't doing business at the time, but in nearby Charleston, the saloon did a two-step and the floor did a shimmy, and experts have concluded that it was in the neighborhood of a 7.5 magnitude quake. From the epicenter, about 40 miles below Douglas in Sonora, Mexico, shock waves radiated throughout 720,000 square miles of the southwest. In southeastern Arizona, the quake caused rocks to careen down hillsides, geysers to gush, and Miss Annie Wood of Tucson to faint. In fact, it shook up a good many folks in Tucson, the Tucson Daily Star reported. The earthquake seems to have disturbed the mental equilibrium of several people. No less than six persons in Tucson have been reported as laboring under fits of insanity, all of whom have been affected since the disturbance of this section of Mother Earth. Small tremblers occasionally jiggled Arizona settlers, but nothing prepared them for that earthquake of 1887. Without telephone or television, hearsay and strange accounts grew to proportions larger than the quake itself. A reporter in Benson knew he had the news break of his life when the quake rattled his windows. As soon as the ground and his nerves stopped trembling, he fired off a story to the San Francisco Chronicle, letting them know Benson had experienced no less than 40 quakes. Knowing Californians wouldn't consider quakes all that newsworthy, he heated up his story with volcanoes spewing from mountains and lava pouring from craters. The volcano story carried as far away as New York, but there it didn't cause much excitement. Most New Yorkers figured Arizona such a primitive place, it was no wonder volcanoes were popping up like something from a primeval scene. By May 5th, the Los Angeles Times reported a volcano in the Total Wreck Mountains, one in the Santa Catalinas near Tucson, and another in the Winchester Mountains around Wilcox. New Mexicans, jealous of all the attention focused on Arizona, started rumors that an extinct volcanic crater above Albuquerque was erupting. the Benson reporter, now at the height of his journalistic career, visioned flames shooting upward 200 feet above the crater and the night sky glowing brightly. Three newspapers carried the same dispatch. The volcanic eruption is pronounced genuine in the Whetstone Mountains. Lava and smoke can be seen from the streets of Benson, nearly 20 miles from the disturbance. Fort Huachuca residents added their two bits to the melee. When they spotted flames at night on the mountaintops, they decided they definitely had a volcano of their own. As proof, they explained, as there is no timber on that mountain and the hills in the vicinity are covered with lava, there can be no doubt that it is an active volcano. Because the quake's epicenter was in Mexico, naturally, the Mexicans needed some volcanoes of their own, newspapers related. A gentleman who arrived from Sonora says there is strong evidence of a volcanic eruption about 40 miles southeast of Magdalena, and it is confidently stated that one peak is throwing out large volumes of smoke accompanied by streams of lava. Probably realizing that one measly volcano wasn't spectacular enough, the traveler added, from the appearance of the country and the heavy earthquakes that have occurred, it is believed that other volcanoes will break forth in a few days. Just as prophesied, within days reports had Babist destroyed by a volcano and another volcano at Hermosillo, wiping out all the timber and pastures in the adjoining valleys. Of course, Arizona promoters couldn't let such a good tourist attraction go to waste. The Tucson Daily Star predicted Arizona would become famous as the home of the only active volcano in the United States. But unfortunately for tourism, Arizona's volcanoes were to sputter out. In Tombstone, where earthquakes and volcanoes took second place to a good gunfight any day, the editor of the Tombstone Epitaph started to question the whole affair. He went so far as to call the Benson reporter a flat-out liar. He wrote, had the man given facts alone, it would have been bad enough, but it seems that it is impossible for him to confine himself to the truth about anything. Reports trickled in that the volcanoes were nothing more than forest fires. Rocks rumbling down the dry mountainsides during the earthquake produced sparks that caused the forest fires. The Benson reporter still held to his volcano story, but now the Tucson Daily Star blasted him. Every vestige of evidence a volcano has disappeared, but the Benson correspondent continues to describe the glare in the sky, the molten lava pouring down the mountainside, the convulsions of the atmosphere in the neighborhood of the supposed active crater. That correspondent is a lightning striker. He is an Arizona editor of Ocheltree. In fact, he is a genuine Arizona daisy. Headlines extinguish the eruptions with sensational water stories. The earthquake disrupted the groundwater and caused some springs to go dry, while others increased their flow. Lakes appeared and disappeared, but the most unsettling phenomena were the geysers. Arizona cowboys, in particular, had difficulty adjusting to the strange geologic events. Trying to control a herd of cattle with the earth shaking and geysers spurting around them was more than the cowmen had bargained for. In When the West Was Young, Arizona Highways, April 1940, James G. Wolfe recalled seeing sheets of water spurting into the air at many places on his trip back into Charleston from the Huachucas. He said, yes, I made fast time, but that was because my horse was frightened like the other animals. I myself was very cool. You should have seen how calmly and carefully I held onto the horn of that saddle with both hands. Most of the water rumors proved to be much more reliable than the volcanoes, but some stretched the imagination. The Tombstone Prospector repeated a story coming out of Mexico that had a lake shoot in the air like a great fountain to the height of at least 100 feet, carrying with it a boulder that weighed a ton. Tucson police were getting mighty tired of all this earthquake talk. The Tucson Daily Star reported, A.O. Nelson, a young man about 20 years of age, is contained in the county jail awaiting an examination as to his mental condition. He appears to be well-educated and is evidently crazy on the subject of earthquakes. Even true stories were bizarre enough to cause folks to question their veracity. At the Abbott Ranch in Sulphur Springs Valley, geysers filled nearby washes and created lakes in the flat plains. A reporter for the Tombstone Epitaph said, the water shot up into the air for a considerable height, about 4 or 5 feet in width, and extended fully 100 feet in distance for miles. The plains were covered with water. Ranch owners, just coming out of a drought, saw dollar signs among the geysers. Roy Pascoli, a ranch spokesman, reported there was sufficient water to supply 100,000 head of cattle and irrigate 1,000 acres of land. He predicted the ranch would become some of the most valuable land in Arizona, but although the water flow proved to be true, it ceased within a couple of days. At the Mormon settlement of St. David, however, the water remained. When the rumbling and undulating stopped, gone were the stagnant, scum-covered ponds, the cause of the town's malaria epidemic. In a short time, the farmers discovered the artesian wells that are still used for irrigation today. The Mormons proclaimed the quake a gift from God. The Mormons weren't the only ones to see the quake as a message from above. Preachers foretold the end of the world, and church going increased as dramatically as the water flow. But in a few weeks, when no further signs of God's wrath were apparent, church attendance dried up. Tombstone, accustomed to a daily dose of excitement, quickly recovered its proper perspective. In the Crystal Palace, they swept up the broken glass and the poker game went on. The Tough Nut Mines suffered little damage, and Staunton and Cheney got back to their digging. Residents knew it was business as usual when the next day the Tombstone Prospector advertised. Notwithstanding the great earthquake yesterday, Petros Corn Cure is all the rage. It took a bit longer for Tucson to calm its nerves and forget the rumors, but the townsfolk eventually agreed with the Arizona Daily Star editor. The day will be long remembered in Tucson as that upon which the big earthquake came this way. And this concludes the Great Arizona Volcano Scare. The next article is entitled, "The Rim Country Rejoiced with Payson Dew When the U.S. Went Dry." Text and photograph by Don Dedera. Promulgated by a constitutional amendment and a congressional act, on January 16, 1620, the United States of America went dry. On the same day, more or less, a piece of Arizona, the size of Connecticut, home of about 1,000 settlers, went wet. In all that remote country below the Mogollon Rim, mainly forested and mountainous, the largest community was a frontier ranch that had begun as Green Valley and grown to a few hundred souls, drawing their mail from a post office named Payson. In an economy tied to burro-powered prospecting and shirt-tail ranching, the barter system prevailed. Doc delivered a baby for a calf. The wagon freighter took apples for his fee. The general store kept a book of credit. A rare $5 gold piece would rattle around town like a dry bean in a mason jar. Then Prohibition arrived. Moral questions aside, it was a rim country godsend. Out in the hill and holler hideouts, where water flowed in a trickle or a torrent, folks revived the age-old arts of fermentation, distillation, and mellowing. Corn whiskey, white lightning, moonshine, Payson Dew. In the speakeasies of Los Angeles, they didn't know where Payson was, recalls one rimrock old-timer, but they sure knew Payson Dew. They knew Payson Dew in Phoenix, Albuquerque, and Tucson, too. Elsewhere in places like Chicago, it is said that Prohibition turned ugly in police corruption and gang violence, but Payson's participation in the circumvention of the Volstead Act was more of a game with a welcome payoff, our old-timer again. This country always was cash poor, and making bootleg liquor put sorely needed money in a lot of old boys' pockets. When I was young in the 1950s with the legs of a half-miler, it seemed that in any far-off corner I could hike, where rain or snow melt fed a little spring, I could count on three things: tracks of big game like elk and bear and lesser creatures, plenty of watercress and greens to freshen a backpack supper, and nearby the archaeological remains, soldered vats, earthenware shards, copper tubing of a moonshine still. Even then, this neck of the woods was not far removed from its pioneer past. The first man buried in Payson Cemetery in the early 1880s was slain by warring Apaches, and two generations later, the hamlet remained a grueling 5 to 6 hour drive over dirt roads to the bright lights. Near to the spring would be moldering a pile of unpainted rough sawn lumber marking an abandoned homestead cabin and maybe a crumbling stone livestock pen. If not a flowing spring, then a hand-dug well. Whiskey begins with a mash of grain softened in water, and a local saying averred, "No water is better than what comes from a hand-dug well." Much is made in movies of gunfighters, but who had more courage than a man alone digging with pick and shovel a pit down 35, 45, 55 feet As all the while the circle of light above him grew even smaller, one collapse of a sidewall, a man could have excavated his own grave. That was only the beginning. The adjacent opening, today a flower-strewn meadow, once bore a stand of ancient pines, some saplings when pilgrims sailed. Each tree must be felled, its bole bucked out and dragged off, the stump removed, the earth plowed and planted, to corn. To this day, by federal law, for a whiskey to be labeled bourbon, the only true American liquor, its mash must have contained at least 51% corn. 2 years of aging in charred oak barrels are likewise required. But when the room went to moonshining, just about anything starchy or sweet, be it potato or peach, filled the vat, and age was measured in minutes. Anecdotes abound. One grizzled chemist died of lead poisoning after sampling his own brew. Another moonshiner charged asthma sufferers 25 cents to sniff the vapors emanating from his bubbling mash. Worked wonders. But good, bad, or lethal, Payson Dew retailed for about $5 a gallon. An operation of any size required tons of ingredients and fuel. Ira A. Murphy tells us in his Brief History of Payson, Arizona, the best estimates refer to a minimum of 20 bootleggers on any given day. One still, on the East Verde, was of such size that large wooden vats were made to handle the mash. Another used a steam compressor that utilized a wagon load of wood each day to keep the still in full operation. Federal agents, elsewhere nicknamed revenuers, were known as prohis along the rim. A stool pigeon occasionally would tip the law to a still's location, but Payson had his counterintelligence network. When a raid was planned, a secret prohi ally would telephone a Payson relative and announce that a fishing trip was in order. As the alarm spread, one moonshine ranch turned loose a herd of belled donkeys to flee into the forest and warn the whiskey makers. When prohibition was repealed in late 1933, the nation rejoiced, but the rim country fell into a season of mourning. Except for a batch run off now and then for old time's sake and home consumption, it meant the end of Payson Dew. And this concludes The Rim Country Rejoice with Payson Dew When the U.S. Went Dry. And that concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you, Arizona. Your mountains, deserts, and streams. Rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.